Welcome to EIR Talks. On January 24, 2002, EIR's founding editor, Lyndon LaRouche, addressed an international webcast from Germany before a live audience in Washington, D.C. via video teleconference. This week, we bring you responses to questions from both the live audience and the World Wide Web.
I have a question from a former member of the Clinton administration. This is a question from Washington, D.C. The question is, Mr. LaRouche, shortly after President Clinton began a discussion of a new financial architecture, his presidency was destabilized. Was the apparatus that you've identified as behind the ongoing coup d'etat against the presidency the same apparatus that was involved in the assault on the Clinton presidency? What are your thoughts on this?
Absolutely, there's no question of that. For example, the major operations against President Clinton, from even before he was president, I think it dates from about August of 1992. But he was immediately targeted by circles associated with the Mellon Scaife Foundation. Now, the Mellon Scaife Foundation is the same thing as the H. Smith Richardson Foundation, which is on record as one of my enemies. Yeah? The Olin Institution, and so forth and so on. So this pack, and also if you look at the Israeli side, the same people on the Israeli side who are operating against the president are also an integral part and allies of the same crowd that Smith Richardson, Olin, et cetera, Scaife upon it. So there's no question of that. Look, you go to what happened. Take the sequence of events. 1996, I warned, look, we're in the end phase of the system. The collapse I've been talking about, we're in the end phase, the last period. And there was a lot of talk in the Democratic Party at the time about what I said. And people saying, well, no, maybe you're exaggerating, or they're saying, maybe there are ways to fix it. Maybe we don't have to do it your way. Maybe we can do it our way. Then you had what was falsely called the Asia crisis, which is not an Asia crisis. I mean, the fact when somebody comes up and shoots a guy with a bullet, the crisis is not caused by the guy who's taken the bullet, but rather by the guy who shot the bullet. And that's the nature of the Asia crisis. The Asians didn't cause it. The people like George Soros caused it. And, all right, so this kind of thing. So then you had a follow-on. You had a swindle which was pulled by friends of Al Gore, which is the GKO crisis of 1998, or the LTCM crisis, which almost blew out the entire U.S. financial system right then and there with a hedge fund collapse. Now, at that point is the point that the president had indicated in September in New York, his indications about looking at a new financial architecture for the international system. And I believed at the time that he meant it. I believed that his Secretary of the Treasury was capable of dealing with that kind of issue in his official capacity, that was the way to go, that simply the U.S. Treasury Department under the authority of its president, the incumbent president, meeting with people in other countries, should enter into the kind of discussion which had been avoided in the 1975 meeting of the international leadership, G7 group. And that something we could start something then. But the president backed down. I don't know why he backed down. I rather suspect he was frightened by some of the information he had about how serious the LTCM crisis really was. But anyway, when it came to October, the president, after walking into Wall Street, the jungle where the lions and snakes and things roam, had gone in there and said, "Gentlemen, I'm going to change your system." And then he walked away and said, "I didn't mean it." That is the worst thing you can do in the face of that kind of enemy. If you threaten them and then run away scared, they're going to come and kill you, particularly if you're in a powerful position. And they did. They had the operation already set up, already in place, and they went ahead with this Lewinsky scandal. And the reason they did that, and the people that did that, now look at the agency in the White House which controlled the White House internal communications. Who is that agency? What foreign power controls it? And what is the political interest behind that foreign power? And there's your answer. Then you take the same thing with the question of the president's dealing with the Camp David negotiations. Now, that was a good idea. I think the president made a mistake in the way he handled the concluding part of the thing. I was afraid of the way the thing was going, because if you don't have an economic angle to this, these Oslo Accords could not work. And then when Barack came in with his threat, you give me, in effect, you give Israel the site of the second holiest place of Islam as a place for a new temple, or else. Arafat had no choice but to say, no, I can't buy that. I think the rest of the package was a good package. It was a good negotiation. It may not have been adequate, but it was a good negotiation and could have been a step toward a follow-up implementation which might have provided the real solution. But then remember what happened. You had in the period of the Clinton administration, you had Rabin, who had been key in the Oslo Accords. He was assassinated and nobody did anything about it. President Clinton tries to do this now with Barack, which I think turned out to be a mistake, but I wasn't really aware of how much a mistake that was, so I can't take credit for that. But then he was suckered by Barack. And when he said, he made a mistake. The president should have said, we had a good agreement, but the Israelis made an unreasonable demand. And therefore, that's why it sunk. If the president had said that, I think we would have been able to manage the situation, and we would not have the present Sharon phenomenon in the Middle East. But this Sharon phenomenon, and the friends of Sharon in New York, who are the financial angels behind Amdocs, are the same thing, exactly the same thing as this September 11th, the same thing as this present Israeli operation in the Middle East, and the clash of civilizations warfare. Look at the list of people who want a bombing of Iraq, who want a bombing of Iran, who want to go into Somalia, who want to do this, who want to do that, who want a clash of civilizations. So what the president was faced with is the fact that he constituted a potential threat to these utopians' scheme for their utopian future. And as I know them, I've been there. Remember, I did a couple of things in my life, like on the SDI and so forth. I stuck my neck out on that and a few other questions against exactly the same enemy: Smith Richardson, Mellon Scaife, Heritage Foundation, Mont Pelerin Institute, Henry Kissinger, Brzezinski, the same mob. And the same mob came after me, went after Clinton. And they'll always do it. They were going to kill me. They didn't kill me. They threw me in prison instead. But that's the way the American political system works under the influence of these thugs and under our present news mass media. And they did the same thing to Clinton. And I was happy that I was able to make some contribution to preventing them from succeeding in the impeachment effort they planned. They wanted to get Gore in there real quick. And if they'd gotten Gore in there real quick in 1999, then you would have had hell on earth right away. But Clinton's presidency was saved. He did some good things. He prevented Gore from becoming president by still being president, and that was a wonderfully good thing. He shouldn't have backed Gore for the nomination election in 2000. But no, I think I just cite this to make a more complete answer. But my view is the evidence shows that there is no doubt that the president was victimized, because he did take these guys on, and the guys he took on is the same nest of snakes which we're discussing under the clash of civilization and the September 11th category.
Thank you, Lynn. I'd like to take another question from the United States. This one is from Senator Hank Wilkins from the Arkansas State Legislature. He says, first of all, Mr. LaRouche, I want to thank you for the help that you've given to America and to the world. What would you say is the best course for elected officials in order to help get the word out to legislatures and other bodies around the nation?
What I think we have to do is we have to get our guts together. And we have to, those of us who agree with this kind of mission, should be working together. Now, that doesn't mean you work together in terms of necessarily always a formal organization. We have formal and informal arrangements that we can work through. But in a sense, we should be in consultation all every week, just through consultation. And we have to make, Donna, two things. We have to clear our own heads on what we think should be done and what can be done. We also have to make clear to the American people, yes, okay, the Democratic Party's a mess, the Republican Party's a mess, don't give up the ship. The president, incumbent president, has certain, shall we say, limitations. But don't give up the ship and abandon the nation because you see these downsides to the problem. If the American people realize that we have in the United States something like that which was typified by the Henry Clay, John Quincy Adams circles during the period of the 1830s, 1840s, and 1850s, we can keep the spark of the American intellectual tradition alive. We can keep the American Revolution alive. And as the American people know that we are keeping the revolution alive, just as Henry Clay and Henry C. Carey and John Quincy Adams and later Abraham Lincoln did during the terrible times of the 1830s, 1840s, and 1850s. Then there will come a time when we can get our nation back. And I think under the present conditions, where the threat is so immediate, and most intelligent Americans can recognize it quickly, that it is immediate, and events will show it very quickly. The problem the American faces, we have to think about the little guy, the fellow out there, a citizen, a student, thinks they're very little. They think they have no power. They think there's nothing they can do about the situation. Well, there is something they can do about it, but they can only do it on two conditions. First of all, that they sense they're part of something big that can do something. Secondly, that they have a kind of leading layer with whom they associate themselves, who will represent them as a leading group of people in these issues. So the important thing is to meet, to discuss, to share, to debate, to argue, but argue as legislators should, for example, to argue the issues, argue the policies, but let the people out there know that outside the mess in the Democratic Party, outside the mess in the Republican Party, in our institutions, there are people of substance, often who have been elected to positions, who are respected, who are meeting, who care about the nation, and who want to do something about it. The American people will respond to that. The problem is the American people have been denied the visibility of an influential institution to which they can turn when they want to get a job done. I know Americans. I've been one for a long time myself. Therefore, I have some inside knowledge of it. Americans are always looking for some guy to talk to who they can get to do something that they think needs to be done, but which they can't do themselves. And what you have to do is give the American that person he's looking for, not one person, that's always useful, but give them a group of people they think they can turn to and have an interchange with, so we can get this thing on the level of discussion from the standpoint of reason, not from the standpoint of just plain lobbying, but the standpoint of reason. And I think that this kind of semi-formal, formal associations, committees, groups, discussion circles, and so forth among political figures can create a force in the United States that the parties cannot ignore.
Thank you, Lynn. I have a question. At least I think that is, that that's what this is, but if it's not, I'll correct myself. This is a question from somebody who is in the gathering at the United Nations in New York. His name is Mr. Hussein. He is a correspondent with the Maghreb Times, which is a newspaper in Lahore, Pakistan. His question is the following. Mr. LaRouche, what do you think, in these circumstances that have been created by the peacemakers, that the future of countries like Pakistan, Iran, and Afghanistan, where still Osama bin Laden appears to be alive and traveling, what type of solutions, either social or economics, can we put together in the future to address our problems and to address things like the current conflict between India and Pakistan?
I can say from my experience, you know, I just was in India for about 2 weeks where I discussed some of these kinds of problems, among others. I was in Russia for about a week with important discussions with people there. I was in Italy recently for discussions there. I've had discussions in other locations in Europe and so forth. And there is a possibility in the world, which I find in the way people are reacting to me. And I, when people react to me, I mean, that means I've got implicitly some responsibility to act in response. I think that if we can pull together around the world, and not just on government-to-government level. Government-to-government is important, but there's also another level on which the options of government are defined. They're defined informally in the shaping of opinion across borders and within borders among groups of people who meet and discuss these precisely these kinds of questions, the kind of question you just posed. Obviously, to me, you have to pick an objective. Not just a negative one. Don't say what would be, from a negative standpoint, desirable. What, from a positive standpoint, will give us a solution? My solution is the same one which President Franklin Roosevelt, in his own way, envisaged for the post-war world. You know, one of the reasons that I'm well-received in some circles in India is because I was in India in 1946. I was in Calcutta during a famous period where there was a virtual revolution, an actual revolution, which did not quite take power but could have. And I am associated in the minds of Indians who know about me with my views and attitudes and activities from those months in 1946 when I was an American soldier returning from Burma into India and was, shall we say, seen and known on the streets of Calcutta and in lots of circles in Calcutta. So therefore, and at that time, I was witness in Calcutta. I was standing on the Maidan in particular one evening, in which there were millions of people marching in protest against an atrocity by the British police in India, which could have brought independence of India then. And as I was walking the street, I heard this crowd, this mass, and the Chowringhee was the street they were marching down by the Maidan. It's a fairly wide street for the times. Packed with queues running for miles. 3 to 4 million Indians marching, maybe more. And the cries from the crowd were consistent. Jai Hind, Pakistan Jadaba. Jai Hind, Pakistan Jadaba. They were brothers. They were brothers with a common culture and a common history. My view is that if we create the idea, not of imperial power, get away from the ideas of Hobbes and Locke and other butchers, and go back to what Nicholas of Cusa proposed in his Concordancia Catholica, a community of perfectly sovereign nation states based on a common principle, a dedication to the common good, the common general welfare, that if we get that idea of that kind of bipolar world, then we will get the possibility of the kinds of discussion that go with it. Because the question of peace involving Pakistan and India is not a formal question. And the Indians are right in saying that the United States and nobody else should go in there and try to negotiate the Kashmir thing. It's between Pakistan and India. It's either it's ever going to be solved. No one else is going to come in with a master plan and solve that problem. Only India and Pakistan can come to a solution on this question. Again, together, of course, with the Kashmiri people. Right? But that, so keep out of it. Don't try to administer a solution. What you have to do is bring about an understanding that we, for the sake of the future of humanity, must at last establish a system, a bipolar system, over this planet, which consists of a community united in principle of sovereign nation states. If we have that idea, and if we as private citizens say our governments are committed to this idea, we are going to meet together to try to make it work, I think we can succeed. It's the best hope we have.
From the Congressional Black Caucus here in Washington. The question is, Mr. LaRouche, what would you say is the appropriate course of action for African American elected officials in speaking out against the clash of civilizations, as well as the increasing abandonment of any commitment to the principle of the general welfare, without appearing to be soft on the question of terrorism?
Well, see, this is a typical problem. We just have celebrated, presumably, those of us who are in a position to do so, we've just celebrated the anniversary of Reverend Martin Luther King. Now, what happened is that when Martin died, the civil rights movement almost died. The veterans existed, but the civil rights movement existed as an organization of veterans of the civil rights struggle. Other issues took over. Why? Because the leaders of the around King were not like King. King was really a Christian. You have a lot of preachers in this country, but not so many real Christians. That King believed in mankind. He believed, as he said in the speech on the mountaintop, with the question of the mountaintop, he believed that he had to put his life on the line for the sake of a purpose for humanity, and that the African-American leader must struggle for humanity, not so-called black interests first. Because when you struggle for humanity, you become a representative of humanity, and you have the power of being a spokesman for humanity, not a special interest. And when you come from an oppressed group and you represent all humanity, you are more powerful than otherwise, because you are capable of rising above the littleness, the piggishness, which most people have about the idea of self-interest. King had that. King united and inspired people with love in his policy, his words. Those who tried to succeed him could not do that. They were too selfish. They were too small in their minds. They were too concerned about things that were small, that King kept them from spoiling the job while he was still there. He would bring them to a higher level. And there were a few people around King who represented that. As my friend, the media, Boynton Robinson, says, the key to the civil rights movement in its hardest struggles in the South was from the have-nots. The people who thought they had something thought their interest was in what they had. The have-nots thought their interest was in what nobody had. The real freedom, a decent society. And they fought. And the people who wouldn't fight for civil rights were the people who didn't want to put at risk what they thought was their special interest. And that's the key to this problem. The problem of the Congressional Black Caucus, it comes under tremendous pressure from an African-American community which is morally demoralized. It does not believe in what Martin Luther King represented. It's very nice that they celebrate his memory once a year, but they do not believe in what he represented in point of fact as I know it, and as other people know it. And African-American leaders of conscience know that. They know that's true. And sometimes I feel like the real African-American leader. Why? Because I believe in what King believed in. But that's the way you have to be. And if you're that, you represent everybody. You care about everybody. You care about what is in our common interest. And the most beautiful thing is to have someone who comes from a stratum which is oppressed, who stands up and says, well, I'm oppressed. I know about oppression. I'm one of the oppressed. I'm not the most oppressed, but I'm one of the oppressed. And I'm constantly, watch out, I'm going to be victimized because there are racists around who hate us. But I'm not going to play that game. I'm not going to wear that bag. I'm going to be a leader. And then people will have to respect what I am. And they will have to respect the people from whom I come because I'm that kind of leader. I mean, one of the greatest things that happened with King was King himself. King was the movement. And that every great leader of a true social movement has that character. They become the personification of the movement. And the love that they and respect that they evoke inspires people. And the movement succeeds. Think of Johnson. Think of the Johnson in 1964 with the Civil Rights Act, including the Voting Rights Act, which the Democratic Party crushed. And some African-American black caucus leaders went along with that, tolerated it. How did that happen? How did Johnson, President Johnson, who's not the worst guy in the world, but how did Johnson come to that hard decision, not only for the Civil Rights Act, but for the Voting Rights Act? How did he come to that decision that year, for which he was bitterly hated, and for which denied him the chance of being reelected president, if truth be known? Because King inspired love. King represented the best quality of the American. And a president had to recognize that someone who could take oppressed Americans and lead them the way King had done and inspire others. You can't deny that, because that's like denying everything good in yourself. And so that's the difference.
You're listening to EIR Talks. We'll return in a moment with more of Lyndon LaRouche's responses to questions during the January 24th, 2002 webcast. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with more of Lyndon LaRouche's responses to questions during the January 24th international webcast.
I've had my fight with Black Caucus people on just this issue. I've had fights again with civil rights organizations repeatedly on this issue. Don't become small-minded. Look at the world. Look at what's happening in Indonesia. Look what's happening all over the world. Don't tell me how bad your problems are. I know how bad they are, better than you do, perhaps, because I'm an economist. Let's talk about what we have to do to change it and to build the kind of system in which this oppression no longer exists. And above all, to build the kind of society in which people love one another, which this kind of thing doesn't go on. And that's where the problem lies. And you guys in the caucus, you've got to come up to that level. You've got to think about King with tears in your eyes and say, have we lived up to that standard? And do we turn to the people who say, tell us we're their leaders? And do we turn to those people and say, you want to lose? Play the game of my little community and my little special interest. Be the kind of guy who says, I don't want freedom, I just want reparations. And you lose. And that's how the losses have occurred. So I'm tough on African-American leaders for that reason. Because what King gave us, like Frederick Douglass earlier, in a different way but a similar way, what they gave to the United States by their courage, by their accomplishment, brought us closer to becoming our true selves than we as a nation could have come otherwise. We just got to stick to that program.
I do understand that we're ready to go to Buenos Aires. Is that true?
Ya lo de Buenos Aires está resuelto, ¿es cierto?
Sí.
Hola.
We have a question from Buenos Aires.
Tenemos una pregunta de Buenos Aires. Adelante, pues.
Buenas tardes, señor LaRouche.
Gracias por su tiempo y por atenderme y tratar de comprenderme y contestar la pregunta.
Good afternoon, Mr. LaRouche. This is Judge Héctor Carlos Acuña from the Criminal Economic Court in Buenos Aires. I thank you for listening to me today and hearing my question that I would like to ask you.
Mi interés es preguntarle.
I'm interested in asking you the following.
Viendo que usted conoce la situación de crisis por la que atraviesa mi patria.
Since you are familiar, you know about the crisis situation which my country is going through at this time.
En donde nos afecta una crisis moral por falta de credibilidad en las instituciones y en las autoridades políticas.
Where we were facing a great moral crisis as a result of the lack of credibility of the political and other institutions of the country.
Y otra crisis económica por la codicia de la banca internacional y nacional.
And another crisis, an economic crisis, as a result of the greed of the national and international bankers.
Lo que veo que usted conoce porque escuchaba atentamente sus palabras.
I see you know about this because I've been listening very carefully to your words today.
Esta situación nos pone al borde de un enfrentamiento nacional y this, peligra la tranquilidad de nuestro país.
This situation has placed us at the edge of a national explosion and is threatening the very national tranquility, national peace in our country.
Deseo preguntarle, atento su vasta experiencia mundial.
I would like to ask you the following based on your vast world experience.
Respecto a qué medidas económicas podrían implementarse.
In the following sense, what are the economic measures that could be applied, instrumented, implemented today?
Para que el presente gobierno de nuestro país,
so that the present government of our country
pueda lograr tranquilizar los ánimos,
so that the present government can manage to calm down the state of exaltation in the country,
pues se encuentra seriamente amenazada la libertad y la tranquilidad de mi patria,
because the freedom and the tranquility of my country is gravely endangered at this time.
Okay. Well, first of all, we have a bankrupt system. The bankruptcy was imposed by the IMF and related institutions. So the person who caused the bankruptcy is largely the IMF system in its post-1971 form. That can be easily documented. That's fact. The bankruptcy was aggravated by putting in a man with the curious name of Caballo, which I would translate as Kabbalah, who played a key role in aggravating the damage beyond belief with his administration and with similar administrations. But essentially, the guilty party is essentially the IMF system in the way the floating exchange rate system was administered in respect to the countries of Central and South America. And Argentina was a special target for destruction because Argentina was in the last century at various points third and fourth ranking in the world in standard of living, productivity, and so forth, despite all smears. It was a great economy. And therefore, that is an insult to those in the North America who think that South Americans have to be stupid and incapable. Therefore, Argentina is a striking example of what a country in South America is potentially. And it's hated for that reason. But the essential thing comes back, the same basic problem. The IMF caused the bankruptcy of Argentina, a bankruptcy which presently, if the present conditions are enforced, Argentina will be biologically destroyed as a nation, and maybe in a horrible way. So therefore, if there is any perception of a principle of natural law operating in the minds of the people of the United States, in the presidents and so forth, the point is Argentina must be given the liberty to reorganize itself in bankruptcy in the necessary way. That would mean, number one, the creation of a new currency outside the existing system and with no ties or obligations to the existing system. The currency would be largely used to ensure domestic security, economic security, and so forth. You would have to accompany this with a series of very strict protectionist measures, and you would have to get into a complex of trading agreements, long-term and medium-term, with adjoining countries such as Brazil, you have some facilities for this already, and others. And there must be a general understanding that Argentina must be given the opportunity to work through such an agreement. We can no longer be concerned with those who are responsible for administering the destruction of a nation. That is a crime, a moral crime. If you impose upon a nation policies which bankrupt it, which threaten its people biologically, which threaten genocidal effects, then your financial claims on account of that system have no moral authority per se. Therefore, your claims are subject to reexamination from a standpoint of bankruptcy proceeding under the principle of the general welfare. And that, so nations must take a view that the principle of the general welfare must be applied to the bankruptcy of Argentina, that Argentina must declare itself bankrupt and declare that its government is taking as a sovereign agency responsibility for reorganizing its affairs and seeks the cooperation of other sovereign countries and bringing things into a durable order on the medium to long term. As part of that, Argentina requires a new independent currency not contaminated by the corruption of any of the previous currencies. And therefore, things should stand at that. But the context in which that decision should be made also has to be considered. The entire system is bankrupt. Argentina is not an isolated case. The entire system, including the United States, is bankrupt. Including Europe is bankrupt. Including Africa is more than bankrupt. The only non-bankrupt nations are a few in Asia, like China and India and so forth. They're not bankrupt. But the rest of the world is actually essentially bankrupt, as a Japan bankruptcy would show in terms of the United States. So therefore, since we're all in a bankrupt system, what we have to think about is the set of rules under which we reorganize ourselves in bankruptcy in order to create a recovery from this bankrupt condition, any bankruptcy. Yeah? In the case of Argentina, we must apply that general policy perception to Argentina and say, go ahead, Argentina, we will now cooperate with you in your bankruptcy reorganization. Go ahead, create a new currency, manage it well, take whatever protectionist measures you have to do it, discuss it with us, and we will try to work out ways to cooperate with you in the recovery of your economy. That is the only way in which this thing can be approached.
Thank you, Lynn. We have a question. The question that I asked you from the Pakistani journalist was not the Pakistani journalist from the United Nations. He was actually from Lahore. We do have a question from the United Nations. I understand we can take it.
Yeah, my name is Mohsin Zahir. I am editor of a Pakistani newspaper, Weekly Sadai Pakistan. My question to Mr. LaRoche is, Mr. LaRoche, would you like to comment on the role of American Taliban, John Walker, who fought in Afghanistan? Thank you.
Well, I think the case of John Walker is a human tragedy. The case of this U.S. National who joined the Taliban, who was, I understand, captured in one of those groups which is rather brutally treated. And this is the immediate question in my mind is the question of the way in which these captives who were taken prisoner, as the world is upset about this Guantanamo camp exhibition, that this is not just. And the key thing in law is the law itself must be just. The law must never seek vengeance. And what is being done in the case of these accused? I mean, this poor idiot with a, for example, Reed, the shoe stamper, right? This poor fool who was obviously used by somebody. He's not a big case. He's not the story. He's a diversion. So he's a mental case. He's a defective personality. Somebody used him. Walker, in a sense, is a victim of a process. He drawn into a process. Who created the process that Walker was drawn into? It's the big Neo Brzezinski. What prison is he sitting in today? Now, John Walker is not important. He's just like a prisoner of war, a poor fellow, was caught into this process. And what's important is the way we treat those captives. If we enforce a law of vengeance, the way this fascist crew that's running Israel does, where's our morality? Will we do that to ourselves tomorrow? And John Walker is interesting because he is an American. How many Americans are we going to do that to tomorrow? The same thing we're doing to Taliban and some other parts of the world in Guantanamo, as I've seen these things on television. Now, that's the issue. It's a very simple issue of what is the standard of justice, of international justice and law, which applies to such cases. And the basic thing we always look for is we don't try to find final answers. I don't believe in the death penalty. I think it's immoral. We don't accomplish anything by it. And I know all the reasons, I've heard all the reasons, I don't believe any of them. They're all nonsense. Right? So we don't try to get an ultimate punishment, ultimate retribution from an individual. We act to defend society. We act to try to bring about a better condition in society. We try to redeem the sinner as the Christian does, not destroy them. And that's the case of John Walker. And the world is going to look at this John Walker case that you've mentioned. They are looking at it in Europe. Even in England, they're a little bit disgusted by it. In Britain. And the way we treat an American who happens to have been part of the Taliban is going to be remembered and looked at as a matter of judgment upon on American law and American practice. I think it's wrong. You take people prisoners, protect society, fine. But don't be an animal when you do it.
For those of you who are listening, you are listening to an international webcast emanating from Washington, D.C., with economist Lyndon LaRouche, who is currently an announced candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination in the year 2004. This broadcast is emanating from Washington, D.C., the capital of the United States. Lynn, we have a question from Wall Street. The question is, Mr. LaRouche, today Alan Greenspan said that the U.S. economy is no longer in decline. I'm glad you're all relieved to hear that. I was actually getting worried. That's good news. Mr. Greenspan said that although unemployment is increasing, the rate of increase in unemployment is decreasing. Therefore, the Federal Reserve will no longer decrease interest rates. No. No. Nokia has reported earnings increases. My question is, is the economy on the mend? Is Alan Greenspan lying, or is he incompetent, or both?
Well, I think Alan Greenspan is frankly insane, but he also is lying, and he's also telling the truth. But this is what you expect from an insane person, this kind of combination of things, and you have to sort it out. In terms of, is he going to stop the decline in interest rates? I think that's true. I think the statement was issued as a package in order to make that announcement. Why? Well, you know what happened in Germany? You know what happened in Europe? On the first of the year, the German Deutschmark went out of existence, according to law, permanently. Germany no longer has a currency. it has a share, or maybe so, in a currency called the euro, or the, in Germany, the euro. The thing is sinking in value by the day. The taxes have gone up, and prices are shooting up throughout Germany, simply as coincidence of this change in the currency. If this process continues, Germany is going to be destroyed. Now, recently, another fact that indicates the German budget, that the Eichel cut in the German government budgets was reported as causing a greater loss of tax revenue than the amount conserved by the cuts in the budget. We are in a situation globally since the summer of 2000, in which the use of monetary aggregate to try to pump up financial markets has reached a critical crossover point corresponding to that reached in Weimar Germany in the June-July of 1923. The point at which the attempt to bail out a financial market by monetary pumping costs more money in monetary emission than you conserve in the debt you're protecting by that bailout. Now, that's the situation the U.S. is in. What has been demonstrated is that the Greenspan policy of pumping, monetary pumping, to bail out a sinking U.S. economy with a succession of cuts has utterly failed. Not only has it utterly failed, but we're now entering a period of a potential hyperinflation, monetary hyperinflation, and a demand for increased tax rates contrary to previous trends. So what we're looking at is a point at which the interest rates will tend not to be cut, not because Greenspan had a stroke of genius, but because his policy of cutting interest rates has proven itself cumulatively to be a disaster. It's also a period in which the pressure will be on in a period of tax cuts to increase taxes greatly. I have answers to that, but that goes into a longer kind of question as to what should be done. But the point is, I think the answer is, no, the economy is collapsing. That's a lie. It's not rebounding back. It will never bounce. Dead bankers don't bounce. The Federal Reserve decision on interest rates, not to cut them anymore, I think that's understandable. It's understandable because we're now entering a period in which the hyperinflationary danger, monetary hyperinflation, is now a very major danger. Is there any sign of growth in the economy? None whatsoever. Bush has admittedly promised to use the U.S. government and the Treasury as a vehicle for trying to pump the economy up. So that's a change. He no longer believes in the free market. He now knows that the government is the only thing that can save the economy. So that's also a change. But so far, Bush has not been able to find out how the government should pump, by what means, and what will work. His present policies are unworkable. So we're in the situation where the policies, there are possibilities for reviving the U.S. economy, but none have been proposed so far by government or by Alan Greenspan. And Alan Greenspan, as I say, is an interesting kind of nut. He's a follower, a disciple of Ayn Rand, and we know what kind of a nut that means. But what is true is he's made a decision not to cut interest rates anymore because it was a bunch of foolishness in the first place.
Okay. Our next question is from Cairo, Egypt, from Professor Mohammed Salim. Professor Salim, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, go ahead with your question. I think Mr. LaRouche can hear you as well.
Yes. My name is Mohammed Salim. I'm extremely glad to be on the webcast with you, Mr. LaRouche, this evening. I had the pleasure of meeting you in Germany last year during the Institute of the conference of the Schiller Institute, and we have just hosted Muriel Mayrak for a lecture in our Center for Asian Studies in Cairo 2 weeks ago, and we are still basking in the afterglow of that great lecture. We are also honored to receive the literature from your institute, which has been extremely useful for us. Let me ask you, Mr. LaRouche, about the situation in the Middle East, because I think you will agree with me that the situation in the Middle East is deteriorating rapidly. And for the first time, you know, George W. Bush has given, you know, Sharon the green light to go ahead and, let us say, finish off the Palestinian Authority, destroy the Palestinian society, and so on. We are witnessing the entire collapse of the peace process in the Middle East. And the impression here in Egypt is that we are about to witness a very ugly era in the history of the Middle East. Now, how do you assess the situation, Mr. LaRouche, in the Middle East from the angle of the America administration, and what could be done in order to prevent the eventual collapse of the political situation in the Middle East?
Well, I'm rather pessimistic. That doesn't mean I'm in a sense, predicting doom in the Middle East, but I'm very pessimistic about the immediate situation. And particularly because of the way the current president of the United States has shifted his position somewhat recently. Obviously, the pressures are tremendous, but the point is, the issue is the way Europe and the United States are treating the role of the present government of Israel. Now look, we have to look at facts. Just as in the United States, we have this really, this fascist conception of warfare in our utopians. That is, those who were like Brzezinski, those who followed Brzezinski, Huntington, Kissinger, and so forth, and military types at the same time. You have, this is a copy of the Waffen-SS theory of warfare. It's a new kind of Roman imperial legion conception, which is the same thing that the Hitler regime concocted when they made their own Waffen-SS operation. What you have in Israel, in a certain section of the military, and you have a running dog who goes along with it, Sharon, who are also utopians of the same type, who have the same fascist mentality as Brzezinski or Kissinger, especially Brzezinski, Huntington, or who are part of this package. Now, if you let these fascists run loose, if you try to negotiate with them in the sense of the fact is that you assume they're going to be rational, you're wrong. But then you have the other condition of the policy of strategy, on justified war. You suggest that somebody go to war with these fascists. Well, under justified war, you say no, because from most sources, a war against these fascists would be a hopeless war if it were conducted, say, by Arab countries at the present time. Why? Because Israel has a nuclear arsenal. And don't kid yourself that the IDF leaders behind this present fascist drive against the poor Palestinians would use those weapons. They would use them against countries in the Middle East. Don't kid yourself. You have to understand their minds. Therefore, who can stop them? Well, the United States government could stop them. Europeans would support the United States government on such a policy. And serious pressure, not this token pressure, but serious pressure could be brought to bear on this. Our big problem in the United States is in the Republican and Democratic Party. More so in the Democratic Party right now than the Republican Party. Lieberman, Lantos, Gore, and what they represent. They are all for a Middle East war. They are for a clash of civilizations war. And this is not new to them. The Republican Party, you've got some idiots on that side, the so-called Protestant fundamentalists, the Temple Mount crowd. They're extremely dangerous. But only if the United States government, in my estimation, to the president, if the president of the United States would tell the Europeans, we've got to stop it now before we have a general Middle East war, because we're reaching the point of no return, as I'm sure many people in Egypt share that view, that estimation. And therefore, the president of the United States must be the president. Forget what he is in the Congress. He's the executive officer under our system of government. He has the liabilities of advice and consent by the Congress, but he's the president. The executive responsibility lies with him and with his relevant officers. And if he tells the European governments, the French, I don't think the Germans want to hear it, but except privately, the Italians and so forth, that we are going to stop this thing now, it would be stopped. I think it's the only chance. And I would think that someone could try to give President Bush, I understand, my reading is he went through a slight epiphany on September 11th. You know, when you're the President of the United States and you realize that you and your defense minister and your vice president all might have been killed on that day, and you, some of your own military were involved in doing it, you have a little bit of an epiphany. You realize you're a very fragile person, despite being the President of the United States, and you begin to think, react accordingly. And then he got the call from President Putin of Russia, and when the President of Russia, who is the other relevant thermonuclear power on this planet, calls the President of the United States and says, I'm trying to bail you out of this coup you're going through, the President of the United States does experience a certain epiphany. I think that George Bush needs a second epiphany. The first one was good, but he needs another injection. The effect of the first one is wearing off. And it's up to him. I mean, actually, we're at a crucial point. Maybe other forces could intervene. I would hope that's the case. But at the moment, from where I sit right now, my bets are on, will the President of the United States be advised and perceive that his personal intervention with his friends in Europe and elsewhere to say we've got to stop this thing now, that's the best chance. I think anything else will tend to fail.
You've been listening to EIR Talks, presenting Lyndon LaRouche speaking to an international webcast of January 24, 2002. To replay this program or to read the full transcript of the conference, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.